This is the Coast 89.7 Weekly News Magazine, Dialogue, highlighting local news stories and events in our Cape Breton communities.
Hello, welcome back to Dialogue on the Coast 89.7. I'm Bill McCush. This week, stepping back in time to visit a castle gatehouse, a downtown center built in the 1800s, and an iconic bakery fit for a pope. We'll hear a story about serving time and reading behind bars. A regional police officer has come from far away to fulfill her dream, and the airport has some special friends on board to help anxious passengers. These stories are coming up on the Coast. The owner of a vacant heritage property in Whitney Pier says he doesn't want to see Bernie's Bakery demolished. The Cape Breton Regional Municipality says Bernie Kokoska Jr. has about 5 months to repair the vacant, deteriorating building or to be demolished. The 82-year-old says his calls on government to help with financial programs are falling on deaf ears.
They are supposed to be our leaders, the people we look up to, and that is not happening. And I'm just wondering how many people were really stung by this.
He says it will be a shame to lose a bakery that made bread blessed more than 40 years ago by Pope John Paul II in Shearwater.
One of the great customs of the Europeans, especially the Poles, the Slavs, the Ukrainian, when a guest comes to your home, you treat him with the best. You give him the basics of life, which is bread and salt. So when Pope John II, or St. Paul II, came to Canada, a Polish choir, St. Mary's Polish choir, was there to greet him. We had a song called Vitaj Mi, Holy Father, Welcome Holy Father. And we presented him with bread and salt. And the bread was made at Bernie's Bakery, and we're very proud of that. It was the first occurrence like that in Canada. It's a historic event. That happened in, I think it was 1984.
The original bakery was built in 1939 on Tupper Street before a fire in the mid-1950s, and there is a connection to the reconstruction of the Fortress of Louisbourg, a National Historic Site.
In the cold of winter, he rebuilt Bernie's Bakery at 12 Meadow Street. And he had a famous architect of Sydney. His son was a lawyer, DeDuto. And he brought many skills with him from Italy, including building 17th century brick ovens. So the first oven in Bernie's Bakery is a 17th century design, baking over 200 loaves of bread at one time. And the engineers from Louisbourg had to come to Sydney to see how it was built so they could incorporate that into the Louisbourg ovens. So that's quite a story as well.
Kokoska says he doesn't want to lose the building or the memories.
The busiest day of the week was Sunday. Everybody from all over Sydney came to, and further, you know, they came from everywhere to get the bread on Sunday. And my dad and I accompanied him. He would start early in the morning, like about 4 o'clock in the morning, to go up and get the stuff ready, you know, the doughs and the sponges and the stuff like that. And he would get fire the oven up and all sorts of things. And we would make fantastic stuff, you know, like, and while we were rolling the doughs and making the pizzas and the rolls and all that, the radio would be blasting. You would have Perry F. Rockwood, Father Sheen on. And it was a more of a religious, it was more of a church than most church. We had the radio blaring. We were working our hearts out, and we were praying at the same time. It was a great memory, great, great memory.
He says the atmosphere was unlike anything he ever experienced again.
The camaraderie was just wonderful, just hearing the songs of praise on Sunday. That was very important. But to see how my father treated people, he treated them with a lot of respect and compassion, you know. He was such a good man. And if anything, you know, just to have that building in his honor would be wonderful. I can remember one of the first days, he was always interested in starting different type of products. And there was a lady, Mrs. Cohn, on right by the university there, at XJC, they used to call it. She had a store. But she taught my father how to make Chewy's bagels. Holy God. You had to boil them, and you had to do it for a certain period, all this stuff. That's why he made great bagels, the first bagels in Sydney. That was a long time ago. God.
Kokoska says he doesn't know what will happen by the deadline, but total repairs will cost about $200,000. It permanently closed in 2019 and damaged by Hurricane Fiona 4 years ago. Dialogues, Cora Perrigo speaks with Deborah Schofield, who's been teaching for 30 years but never imagined that she would end up teaching and promoting literacy to people in custody.
It's interesting, each building is a little bit different, but Correctional Services has teachers in each of our adult facilities, and in one facility we have an education liaison officer, and so teachers provide services to persons in custody. It could be a wide variety of different things, and it's really about the choices that persons in custody would like to explore. So it could be improving their literacy skills. It could be working towards the high school equivalency, which is called the CAKE, the Canadian Adult Education Credential. It could be working on transition to college modules with the intent of exploring post-secondary, something like NFCC. It could also be working on public school programs if that is the fit for them. So it's really a variety of services that teachers offer to persons in custody, depending on what their interest and need is.
What does the, I guess, enrollment, I'm not sure if that's the right word, what does that look like from people who are incarcerated? Are they, do you find people are receptive to the programs? Are they excited and willing to start them?
Very much so. The people that are in our buildings that identify education as something that they want to work on, they're really motivated. And we have small class sizes with teachers that have great experience and kind of meeting students where they are. So the goal is to provide the classroom as a safe place for people to achieve and to be able to kind of let their guard down in terms of what their needs are when it comes to education. And sometimes the folks in our buildings haven't had great opportunities in education, and there's lots of different reasons that contribute to that. But when people are motivated and are willing, and teachers are able to provide the support that they need as individuals, it is a great opportunity. We just had a young guy earn his high school diploma through the Canadian Adult Education Credential on Friday afternoon, and he earned his diploma, and he was so proud of himself, but so were the people that were in his day room. They celebrated his success just as he did.
And what are some of the misconceptions you come up against?
Well, you know, the misconceptions are that people in custody have learning difficulties, have disabilities, that they're not able to learn, all of those kinds of things. I've been a teacher for 30 years, and I would say that that's a misconception that is very, it's probably still very relevant, but it's so untrue. We have folks in our buildings that are talented people in terms of education, but for whatever reason may not have been able to finish their high school diploma. Or we have folks that found school really difficult and they didn't feel that they belonged there, and so that created challenges for them. But I think when teachers are able to assess and meet students where they are, use formative assessment skills, and students then identify who they are as learners, and that it's okay for them to talk about what their learning needs are, and that not everybody learns the same, and that we're all different in the way that we approach things, that it kind of normalizes it for us all, both teachers and students. And it gives people a chance to kind of engage and to really put forth their best foot when they feel that the support is designed with their needs in mind and not with just kind of a cookie cutter approach.
Hmm. Was this sort of what brought you, you know, you said you've been teaching for 30 years. Is this what brought you to, you know, wanting to bring education to people in custody?
No, I never planned to teach in a jail. In fact, I didn't even know that jails really existed because I had no experience with it. But I started at the Nova Scotia Youth Facility 30 years ago, and it was a great opportunity to meet lots of folks who really were interested in education. And I've always found the work really rewarding because I think when people in our buildings find out who they are as learners, it's kind of like it unlocks a superpower, right? That gives them the opportunity to be able to leave our buildings and say, this is who I am as a learner. This is what I need. And so they can advocate for themselves. They can let other people know what it is that they need. And instead of kind of swirling around, they have a clearer picture of who it is that they are, what their goals are. And we work a lot around what are your goals and how would you like to achieve those and what does that mapping look like. So I think it's rewarding work. The young guy the other day, when he earned his high school diploma, he wanted his picture sent to his mother. Hmm. You know, he's a young guy, he's 32 years old, and it's still his mother, and he wants his mother to see that he graduated. You know, it doesn't get better than that.
Can you touch on the benefits of literacy and education for people in custody?
Absolutely. I mean, when we think about literacy and education, the more that people are able to achieve in terms of earning high school diplomas, it makes them more employable, it makes them feel better about themselves, it reduces their risk in terms of criminal activity, but it also has kind of positive benefits in our communities. People feel that they can engage in community because they feel now that they belong. And sometimes when you don't have a high school diploma, there's a lot of shame, perhaps, and embarrassment, and yet we know that it's a hard road and sometimes it's very difficult to achieve. But when people earn that diploma, they feel like it changes who they are as a person. And I'm not saying that it's the be-all and end-all, but it's kind of one step in that journey of becoming a member of society, because now you kind of feel like everybody else. But it's also for families. We have folks that now can say to their children, well, I have a high school diploma and you should work towards a high school diploma. Mm-hmm. So it's about dad feeling that he can say that to his child now. And, you know, sometimes schools aren't designed for boys and for lots of folks that have different learning challenges. And so what we want to do is to have parents there that are going to support their continued engagement in school when things are kind of tough. And when dad has a high school diploma or he's working on different aspects of education, it really empowers him. And for the women that we have as well, for them to support their children as the mothers, so that the children can stay engaged in school. And that creates a new generation of people that, you know, hopefully can leave with high school diplomas.
You kind of touched on it a little bit, but can you speak a bit more on the effect of literacy and education for people in custody on the effect it has on recidivism?
Well, you know, recidivism is one of those things that's kind of challenging to measure. Our goal really is to look at who the people are in our building and to be able to help them understand who they are as learners. And I think that there's a natural follow through that if people understand who they are as learners, if they work towards a high school diploma, then they become more employable and then they're able to kind of live lives in communities where they're contributing to their families and to their overall communities. And so it kind of fits that if you feel like you belong as a member of a community, that you're more likely to stay there and perhaps not engage in other activities that might lead to a return to custody. Sometimes the people that we see, they don't always feel like they belong because they don't have a high school diploma or they don't have an understanding of who they are as learners. And they're really looking to live a different life because they have dreams and they want to do something. They want to be a plumber or they want to be a carpenter or they want to be a paralegal, whatever it is, the path that they have for themselves. Despite the fact that they might have come through our doors, they still have those dreams and ideas. And our goal is to help set a plan in place that puts them on that path. And I think that that's what contributes to recidivism, is when people can kind of see themselves as functioning members of society.
Is there anything kind of more social that's based around literacy? That's any kind of programs like that available?
The Halifax Library has staff that come into the correctional facility in Dartmouth at Central Nova Scotia Correctional Facility, and they offer a book club to people that are in our building. Now, it's, again, we have a large number of people, so it's a number of people that we have that can come down and participate. But the Halifax Library brings the books in. They give the books out to the persons in custody. They go back and read the books, and then they come back the next week and chat about the books. And so that's a program that's offered in the men's facility and also in the women's facility. And surprisingly enough, it's a really popular program. Hmm. But it's also about attaching people to the library as well, because that's an outside resource that when people are released, that libraries have changed over the years, and they offer many more services than they ever did before. So it's the book club that is really interesting, but the library also gets to share kind of their community support as well. So people then have an additional resource when they leave custody. Like, for example, at Halifax Library, you can get a Nova Scotia ID. That's a service that they offer. So there's an education piece, but there's also the book club and the social piece. And surprisingly enough, you wouldn't think that book clubs would be something that people would be interested in, but they are. And we have one example of a fellow who calls home, and his wife gets the book for the book club as well. She reads it at home, and then when they have their conversations on the phone, they talk about the book club. And so I think it's really a great example of kind of how those stereotypes or ideas about people, that it gives us a chance to broaden our understanding of who people are in custody. And sometimes they're just looking for average, ordinary things to do that will support their families and increase their attachments to partners and other family members.
How would you suggest, maybe someone who's listening has a family member or a loved one who's in custody, how could they support them in their literacy and education journey while they're in custody?
Well, that's an interesting question, but I think it's always about helping people understand who they are as learners. And sometimes for some people, school is really easy and they figure it out. But for other people, they need a little bit more help along the way to figure out who they are as learners, because there may be some different factors and some complexities in there. And so it's really about understanding that all people are looking to achieve and to feel successful and to engage in literacy, because literacy is such a prevalent part of our lives. But it's really providing those opportunities to have conversations about books, to be able to read with their children, and to encourage people to find those places where they can increase their own literacy skills. Because it's amazing what people can accomplish in a very short time when they're motivated and they feel supported in an environment.
Airport in Sydney has some new recruits to help people with a fear of flying. Jacob Hostewade has more.
Some furry friends are now helping see passengers off at the Sydney airport. A new therapy dog program from St. John Ambulance is now up and running for travelers passing through the J.A. Douglas McCurdy Sydney Airport. There are currently two volunteer dogs in the program. Franklin, who is there for midday and late afternoon flights, and Rosie, who will be around on evenings and weekends. Taylor Ranney is an elementary school teacher at Atuada Lacadie in Sydney and is the owner of Rosie, a three-year-old Yorkie poodle mix. They've been volunteering through the St. John Ambulance Therapy Dog program since September, and Ranney says so far they've been visiting a local nursing home once a month.
It's been a really rewarding experience seeing her bring so much joy to other people. Over the past couple of years, she's my very first dog ever, so it's been a new experience for me. Having a dog and being able to go to places and, you know, just go for a walk and seeing her get excited to meet new people. So that's kind of why I wanted to start volunteering with the program. I learned about it just through some friends that have been involved with it. So I kind of, we really lucked out with temperament. She's a really, really sweet dog. She loves to meet new people. So I knew that I kind of wanted to be able to give back to the community and start volunteering with the program.
She says in the new year, they started looking for other places to volunteer and were linked with the airport. Randy says they're looking forward to seeing off passengers.
Flying can be something that causes anxiety. People are anxious before they're boarding a plane. So I figure it would be a really great spot to kind of bring joy to people while they await their flight.
Randy and Rosie will be in the area before entering security with a St. John Ambulance vest and bandana, respectively. Director of Business Development at the airport, Courtney Davis, discussed how the idea was developed.
We live in a place where hospitality and experience, the bar is set pretty high. So we're always looking for new ways to elevate that passenger experience. We're always looking for new partners. We're always looking for fun things to do. And this was one. St. John Ambulance does offer it in a number of other airports, and it's always been very well received, and it was certainly well received in Sydney. So we partnered with them, and it's been great so far. We're going into our third week of it.
She spoke about the benefits of the program.
Air travel, even when you're traveling for fun, sometimes it can be stressful. It's certainly stressful for a lot of people. It might be anxiety about flying or a delay or a connection or even, just the pace at the airport. And so these therapy dogs, the idea was to provide, a little extra support, a moment of connection in an environment that can certainly sometimes be stressful. And really, it just comes down to, a short interaction that creates a positive experience. We've seen, it helps to lower stress, improve mood, and it just makes the entire experience more positive.
Davis also discussed the response to the program so far.
Yeah, we certainly live in a community that loves dogs. We have gotten a lot of feedback about the program, watching passengers, watching staff members. It's been great. We have posted on Facebook that we offer it, and the comments were so positive, and people were excited to see it. We've been doing a lot of work the last couple years to kind of up our game and, make sure we're offering that experience. And this one was just so lovely and so well received.
Davis says the two dogs involved with the program have done incredible work so far, and they're looking forward to a strong summer season. The airport encourages anyone taking a flight to stop by and say hi to their new dogs.
The Moxham Castle Gatehouse in Sydney has been designated as a municipal heritage property. Arthur Moxham originally built the castle in Ohio before agreeing to come to Sydney in the late 1800s to be the general manager of the Dominion Iron and Steel Company. The castle was destroyed by fire in the 1960s, but the gatehouse remains on King's Road. Cape Breton Regional Municipal Councillor Elder McDonald says the castle made a lasting impression.
You hear the stories and everything about it, and you see the photos and you see the prints and whatnot of people that do paintings of it. So it was obviously quite the building. Some of the story behind it and how it was dismantled from Ohio and taken here and put back together is quite a fascinating story in itself. The history behind that building in itself, as opposed to just, and that's the castle in particular that I'm referencing there, but the history and the story is quite fascinating, but to know that the gatehouse is still standing there and protected is a great thing for our community.
Before moving to Sydney, Moxham had a bit of a problem. His wife didn't want to leave her castle in the States, so they simply took it with them, piece by piece.
So it was a move because of employment and the steel industry, and everything was going to be prospering here, and there was a lot of immigration happening, and this particular gentleman was coming this way to want to be part of that movement, and his wife wasn't as keen on that as he was. So she loved her home. She didn't want to leave her home. She didn't want to relocate. So the compromise was, we can keep your home. We'll take it with us. So he had it actually dismantled, shipped here, and then put back together here. So it was a very large undertaking. I don't quote me on the number, but I think it was somewhere in the vicinity of $350,000 or something, which back in those days was a tremendous amount of money. I don't know what those numbers would be today in 2026 dollars, but to think that someone would take a castle of the caliber that that was and to take it apart piece by piece and then put it back together is quite fascinating. So that's how they ended up here, and unfortunately...
After a series of family tragedies, the Moxhams returned to the U.S. and they only used the castle during the summer months. The building later became fitted to be a hospital during the First World War. Eventually, the building became vacant and ransacked by vandals and then destroyed by the fire in the 1960s.
Much like vacant buildings we still have today, they had vacant buildings back in those days also. Not as much as today, but unfortunately it did succumb to fire, which is a tragedy because if it was still standing today, I suspect it would probably be one of the most attractive heritage properties in our community, and probably a lot of tours going through it, like we see in the North End with the tours with the cruise ships, Cosset House and Jost and St. George's Church and all of those iconic buildings that may have been the most iconic if it was still remaining. So, and there's I'm hoping maybe to have some more projects come forward heritage status wise. There's a property that has quite another story and history to it that gentleman has approached me, and we were working on it when COVID happened, and then since then it kind of come off the table, but he's approached me again and said he would like to get heritage status on that. So stay tuned, we might have another building that has got a good storied history behind it also that should be protected.
All that remains now is the gatehouse on Kings Road, where it sits not far from the castle's original location, and council has agreed for it to become a heritage property. Council's report says it resembles a delicate gingerbread cottage. The white and pale blue trim two-story wooden structure is a fine example of turn-of-the-century architecture and craftsmanship. Little, if any, of the house has been altered over the years, except for a new roof and changes to accommodate modern electrical and plumbing facilities. Brent Regional Police Force has a new officer on board. Shashi Jareel, the first Indian female constable to serve on the force, speaks to Cora Perrigo about her hopes to inspire others to follow their dreams.
I came here as an immigrant here in 2019 as an international student, of course, in CBU.
What kind of drew you to the Cape Breton Regional Police?
So since when I was a kid, I already always had a dream of joining defense. I more was in, like, because my grandfather was an army officer, my uncle, they were all army personnel. So I really, really wanted to join defense, but I never tried that in India. So when I came here, moved here, I was going CBU and doing my, like, I was studying and everything. And then I thought, you know what? I had a dream in my life that I wanted to join defense. How about I just give it a try? Because there were several things that was happening in my life and was not able to find a way. So I thought, you know what? Let me just, you know, fulfill a dream that I once had. So yes, then that's where I started thinking about it. And so initially I was more towards army, and then I thought, you know what, I'm going to join police because, yes, I was seeing all the officers on the roads. And one time when I was working at some of the private company, I was working there, and I saw a police officer coming there and helping. And obviously in the movies, I was amazed the work they do always in helping people and everything. So I really wanted to do that. So that's how it started.
What were you originally studying?
So I wanted to pursue higher studies. So there is a story behind it. So very personal to me. So it's very personal, just because I was married with a person. We had a dream together that we want to come to Canada and have our own life. So that's how it started, coming to Canada. So I thought, I'll give it a try. I'll apply for higher studies. And because we were not able to find really great jobs over there because of the competition. So that's how I started and thinking about it. So we both planned actually to come here and start our life. So I applied for my visa here and got accepted in CBU and in my engineering field. So that's why I came here for higher studies. Yes, it was my husband's dreams, but I guess now we are not together, so it's my dream. So that's how I started thinking about myself, have a life for myself, not living for others. So that's how I started it.
It's funny you say not living for others, but then the position you went into, you were specifically inspired because you saw people kind of helping others. Do you find that interesting?
Yes. Yeah, because so initially, before, I never thought of myself. I was kind of whatever was people telling me. I was doing that. Oh, can you do this? Let's do this. I never had that dream of myself. Okay, what I'm going to do actually? What makes me more happy of maybe if I'm helping other? Because before it was not helping other. It was just whatever everybody was telling me. I was doing that. But this one is different. Here I have that power and I have that authority that I can help others. That's a very different from what I had before and what I have now.
So with that desire to help others, I know a lot of people have a negative view of the police. Do you keep that in mind when you're dealing with the public?
Sometimes, sometimes it comes in my mind, yes, there are people who have negative thinking about police. And, somehow I also think, I cannot change other people's perspective. But I always make sure if I'm going on a call, if I'm dealing with a person, if I'm dealing with anybody, I always make sure I provide them that comfort that they can come to me, they can speak to me, and they're not afraid of calling 911 that they're in in any position where they should not be. So that's how I try to make sure. But like we said, if there is yin, there is gonna be yang, right? So there will be good, there will be bad. So it doesn't bother me. It just I make sure that everybody feels safe when we are out there.
And as kind of the first Indian female constable, what's it like to be able to serve, especially with this community that's constantly changing, constantly getting more diverse? What's it like to serve, I guess, people of your own community in this community?
First thing, when I was applying in the Atlantic Police Academy, I had that dream. This crown, I'm going to take this crown as a first female Indian officer here in Nova Scotia, because I never seen anybody here. And I had that dream. So when I started, I worked towards it. And then what was the rewarding part of when I became that? The people of my community, they really reached out to me. They came to me. They were inspired, especially women. So that's how I see it. I could inspire somebody, some women who feels they have a life. They can do this. If anything bad happens in their life, there are ways they can, they can move forward. They can think, they can dream. So if I'm working in this community, I feel very proud as well, because I came here in 2009, and since then this community really helped me. I'm here because of everybody around me, not from my people, from my country. It's from everywhere, everybody who opened their arm for me and accepted me as who I am.
Has it been difficult, like, starting out? Or, like, did you find anything that... Did you come, I guess, like, up against anything that made you be like, okay, maybe I don't want this? Or anything that made you question?
No, not really. I never thought of that. No, because there, like I said before as well, there are good people, there are bad people, and it's everywhere. So I don't let those thoughts affect me. And it all, like, whatever happened, even bad situation, I learn from them and I try to, you know, move forward. I don't look back. So it didn't bother me at much. And there are many things that sometimes we, as a person of diverse, right? So sometimes I get the comments of right, racism. So yes, sometimes we do get such comments, but you know what? That doesn't affect me at all, because I know I'm here in this profession and I'm going to hear many bad things, but there are good things as well. So it just balances everything out. So I don't pay attention to that. I make sure even if there are some things, the person must be going through some things. That's why they're saying things. I'm a very spiritual person, and I feel like if anybody is saying some like bad words or anything, they're going through some problems or something. So I always make sure that the person who's in front of me or the community I'm dealing with, they don't feel like I am kind of ignoring them or anything. I treat everybody equally. It doesn't matter if they're coming from my community or from different community. It doesn't matter for me. I treat everybody equal. It's not like I'm a police officer and there is law and that and to follow and everything. And I make sure that I do that. I don't make anybody feel like they are low or they're high. I keep everything in balance.
And so you've been doing it for about 17 months. You know, I kind of talked about what challenges have you come up against, but you found it to be very affirming. Have you had any, you know, without kind of breaking any kind of confidentiality, but have you had experiences that reaffirmed that this is what you want to do, that really kind of solidified the idea that you wanted to be on the police force?
For us, every day is a new day. We never know like what's gonna be our day like. It's all, we have that positive, like I have that positive mindset when I wake up, whenever I have to go to shift. Okay, I don't know what's gonna happen today. It could be positive, it could be negative, but I'm not gonna let this affect me as a personal. So obviously for me, it's I will get that thought, but I don't let that thought affect me like from inside. So yes, obviously yes. Sometimes we have very bad situation. We are, you know, people are there at very lowest, and that's how I feel. Oh no, I'm glad that I was there and I could hear them. They just want to talk. Sometimes people just want someone to hear them. That's all. You don't have to do anything. You don't have to say anything. Just stay there and listen to them. And there are many situations like that where I was staying there and just listening to them, and which made them feel heard. So yes, yeah. So like every day, like I said, there are many things that's going on. We never, as a normal person, we would never know until you're in this profession. Yes.
And is this something you see yourself doing long term?
Yes, absolutely. I'm going to do this. Yes. Yeah. Long term, I think about it. Yes, I'm going to stay here for long, because, like I said, I started my new life here. When I came here as a student, I had this dream and I really wanted to make a change in community. Like I wanted, sometimes when I get that comments from my friends, families and people, like friends of friends and people outside, and when they said, oh, they're inspired by whoever knows my like personal life, they tell me that you're strong, they're inspired by my life, which this actually gives me inspiration of doing more for them. Like, yes, I think I'm doing something great, which makes like they are inspired by me, so I should be doing a lot for them. So that's how it keeps me going. So yeah.
Do you have a message to the public? You know, like you said, you don't want people to be scared to call 911. But yeah, do you have some sort of message?
Yes, I do want to say this to everyone out there, whoever listening to me. Don't be afraid of anything. please don't be afraid of reaching out to us. We are also human beings. Before we are police officers, we are human beings. We will understand you. It doesn't matter if we are wearing a uniform or something, but deep down, we are also a human being. We are like you. We all bleed red. So no matter what diversity you come from, no matter what, you just reach out to us and never be afraid of anything. And just, I would say, just keep going, because nothing is impossible, because impossible says I'm possible.
YMCA of Cape Breton recently marked its 140th anniversary, and the organizers held a ceremony at the Y in downtown Sydney featuring photos, articles, and reports throughout history. Jacob Hostewaite has the story.
Those currently responsible for managing the YMCA spoke to the group of attendees about its impact on the community over the last 140 years. Chair of the Board of Directors Jill Perry spoke about what the YMCA means to her personally.
I've been a member of YMCAs across Canada, and I've been a member of this YMCA since I moved here 25 years ago. It has been of incredible importance to both me and my family. Fitness classes keep me relatively sane. My kids learn to swim here. So it's a very big and important part of me and my family's life in Sydney. But as anyone who signs up to be a health and fitness member knows here, it doesn't take very long before you realize that when you sign up to be a member of health and fitness, you are getting the ultimate BOGO. Because what you're buying is a gym membership, but what you're getting is so much more. And it doesn't take long of just coming through that door and seeing what's happening around you every day to realize that you are a part of something so much bigger than you there getting your endorphins in your spin class. Because you don't have to scratch very far below the surface to see and to know all the stuff that the YMCA is doing in this community for people every day. And it's not, as I said, about just the gym and a swim. It's about caring for our children in the child care center. It's about helping our seniors get together in our community room upstairs and learn to cook meals. It's about welcoming newcomers to our community. It's about ensuring that people in the community, regardless of their income, are able to come and have a workout or take their children to swimming. It's also about being there for the community in times of crisis. It was incredibly touching to see how the Y responded during Fiona, and you come in here and see people just hanging out, charging their phone or having a shower. So the YMCA has been an incredible part of this community. And if you look at the photos or take some time to wander around and see all the historical pieces, you realize that that's 140 years of being that important part of the community. 140 years of bringing smiles to people who walk these hallways. And let's face it, this is a community that has faced many challenges over the years, over those 140 years. It's a community that continues to face many challenges. And this YMCA is a critical part of responding to those challenges on a daily basis, on a monthly basis, and on a yearly basis. And we could not do that without the absolutely incredible staff and force of volunteer force that we have. It really is amazing. You, the staff who are amongst us, the volunteers who are amongst us, are the people that make this happen every day. So if we could please just have a round of applause for staff and volunteers.
CEO Sabrina Vatcher spoke about the impact of the YMCA and looked back on their history.
140 years, that's generations of service, generations of people believing deeply in the potential of one another. Imagine Cape Breton in 1886. The air filled with sounds of shipyards and coal mines and communities bound together by resilience and hope. In that year, a small group of visionaries planted a seed, a place where people could gather, learn, grow, and support one another. That seed was our YMCA of Cape Breton. From those early days to the present, our Y has remained grounded in the simple but powerful belief that strong communities begin with strong people, and strong people are nurtured through connection, compassion, and a sense of belonging. For 140 years, we've been so much more than a building or a program. Think of the thousands of lives that have been touched by the YMCA, the children who have learned to swim, the teenager who found their first job, the family who found community from a new country. These aren't just stories, they're the heartbeat of the Cape Breton. Through economic shifts and social changes and moments of great challenge, including recent years, has tested all of us. Our why has remained steady in our mission to connect and ignite the potential in people, helping them grow and give back to our communities. Now, a bit of a timeline for you. The pleasure that I have had reading through the YMCA story for the past 140 years, I would need hours to really tell you about all the incredible stories of impact that our Y has had, but if you'll just allow me to share a couple of moments here. In the early 1900s, our Y established a permanent home on Charlotte Street, expanding recreational and leadership programming for youth in a rapidly growing community. There was also great development in the physical education programming, and at the time, the Y owned a playing field in Westmount, and many seasons of activities were carried on there, the groups traveling over to Westmount by boat. After the original building was destroyed by fire, volunteers ensured that services continued uninterrupted. An early example of the determination that still defines our YMCA today. During the First and Second World Wars, our YMCA stepped forward once again. By the time World War II, our YMCA owned a downtown building overlooking Sydney Harbor and was serving more than 600 meals a day to visiting Canadian troops, offering comfort, care, and a sense of home during uncertain times. Basketball has enjoyed a long tradition at a YMCA. If you didn't know, YMCA is the original founders of basketball and volleyball. Maybe that's why it's in my blood so much, and there's my connection, but we are the founders of those two sports. And since the early 1900s, recreational and competitive teams have been playing at this YMCA. Women participated in the sport recreationally as well in the early part of the century. In the late 40s and early 50s, our Y competed in provincial senior men's league and often defeated teams from across the province. They won several provincial championships at the time and played to standing room only crowds. In 1943, a youth outdoor camp called Camp Bearshaw was born. It was initially constructed and operated by the Sydney Wiseman Club in cooperation with our Y. In the late 70s, the full operation and responsibility of the camp was turned over to the Y. For 60 years, we provided overnight accommodation, leadership, and recreational programming for youth. Thousands of campers spent a part of their summer childhood at Camp Bearshaw, and you'll see lots of memorabilia here today. And that's one of the greatest stories, or the most common stories that are here from past members, volunteers, is their time at Camp Bearshaw. During the 50s, 60s, and 70s, our Y's continues to be an open door to fun, friends, and sportsmanship. Our facility was in constant use with groups other than members used our building as well, including the municipality of the County of Cape Breton, which held court sessions at the Y after the courthouse had burned down at that time. In the early 70s, Sydney saw the beginning at the YMCA of what is now the Cape Breton Dorados swim team, which has since transitioned to the Kiwanis Pool in Sydney after the Y's later temporary closure. The early 70s also saw the start of a recreational synchronized swimming club, and it continued until 1981. In 78, we opened the doors to our first children's center, and by 1984, we had spaces for over 100 children during the week. In the early 80s, our financial difficulties caused our Y to close temporarily. But within a year, our organization was operational again. And that's in big thanks to our local Y Service Club for stepping in during that time. In that decade, an extension was also completed to our Charlotte Street site with a pool that was in the basement. I hear a lot about the pool in the basement over and over again. A gymnasium, racquetball, squash court, weight room, auditorium, and the preschool center. In 86, we hosted 10 other YMCAs and 125 leaders and staff to organize a Leaders Corps rally. The aim of the rally was to provide an exchange of ideas and skills and gain insight how other Leaders Corps operated. In 1987, our association expanded into Glace Bay with the opening of the YMCA Enterprise Center, launching employment and entrepreneurship programs that helped hundreds of people access training, confidence, and opportunity. Today, we operate numerous Nova Scotia work centers and employment special projects right across Unamagi. In 2010, a major development led to the expansion of where we are today, our Frank Rutterham Family YMCA, a 60,000 square foot facility, allowing for expanded programs for children, families, and a pool that wasn't in the basement. That was a highlight. In 2016, the Y and Member 2 developed a joint venture for our YMCA to operate the gym facility at the then new Member 2 Sports and Wellness Center. Today, we are 10 years strong and growing. From 2019 to 25, we grew our presence in license and after school care, first opening infant spaces in our early learning centers, then opening after school programs across the island, and most recently, three new early learning centers. Today, we serve 500 children in our early learning centers and after school programs. Since 23, under the leadership of our philanthropy team, we strive to grow our culture of giving and have secured countless grants and donations to support new health and wellness programs for seniors, mental health programs for youth, a rapidly growing financial assistance program for members, and our children attending our summer camps. In 2024, we began providing housing and homelessness services in Western Cape Breton, helping individuals find safe and dignified places to call home. But today's not only a celebration of time, it's a celebration of people. And I echo Jill's sentiments. To our staff, past and present, thank you for bringing the heart, professionalism, and care to this work every single day. You are the soul of our YMCA. To our volunteers and our donors, your generosity of time, talent, and treasures has made every program, every success story, and every life change possible. To our community partners and supporters, your trust and collaboration allows us to reach further and serve better together. And to those who have walked through our doors, and I'm so glad to see our members here today, over the past 140 years, this celebration also belongs to you. Your stories, your resilience, and your achievements are a true legacy to our Y.
To mark the occasion, the YMCA presented a Lifetime Achievement Award to Carol and Wayne Beaton for their over 50-year commitment to the Y. Carol began her time with the Y by bringing her child and then grandchild to swim lessons. She found connection and community at the Y, becoming a member of the board of directors and helped start the YMCA preschool program.
That's all for Dialogue this week. If you have an idea for an interview on the program, send us an email to news@coastalradio.ca. Thanks for listening. I'm Bill McCush.